You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Brookings. I'm Mike O'Hanlon with the Foreign Policy Program. We have a special treat today, although on a very difficult subject. We're talking about South Sudan, one of the most conflict-torn and fragile countries in the world, also one of the newest countries in the world, and there had been great hope that its independence and its self-determination would lead to a period of peace, and that has not happened. We're going to learn a lot about the course of recent events over the last decade or so, but specifically the last 5 years in today's discussion, and then look forward to what policy options still are available to the international community as we wrestle with the possibility of an even worsening situation in South Sudan today. The way we'll proceed, we're really fortunate and thrilled to have Hilda Johnson with us today. She's just completed a book that you're all invited to consider purchasing, and it's available in the back of the room, and you can do that at any point during the next hour and a half. It's called South Sudan, The Untold Story, From Independence to Civil War. So it's not a happy read, but it covers most of the decade, really the whole half decade, I should say, since 2011 and independence, primarily the 3 years when Special Representative Johnson was the UN Special Representative in South Sudan, living there, working there from independence through the summer of 2014. But there is also an epilogue, and a lot of the narrative carries us into the future and the debates that we need to have going forward as well. So the way we'll proceed is that she will begin with, even though we have an informal conversation set up here physically, she'll begin with a bit of a presentation, which summarizes some of the story of the independence of South Sudan. Many of you know there was a comprehensive peace agreement, peace accord, a CPA, that was devised with her help and others in 2005, and that gave South Sudan the option of independence, which it ultimately did exercise as of 2011 after a 6-year interim period. She wrote an earlier book about some of that time, but now we're really focused on the last 5 years. And so she's going to tell that story, perhaps also signaling a little bit about future options for the international community. But we'll also save that topic for the second half of our discussion a little bit. And I'll come back to that as moderator, at which point after her presentation, I'll introduce Princeton Lyman, who obviously is one of our nation's great Africanists and who was also the United States Special Representative for South Sudan during much of this crucial period, and Brian Adeba, who is South Sudanese by origin, Canadian by citizenship, Washingtonian by current residence with the Enough Project, and who will also contribute enormously to the conversation, as will you, because after 45 to 55 minutes or so, we will then go to the audience for comments and especially your questions for the panelists. So let me just say a brief additional word about Hilda Johnson, and then we'll go right to her presentation. Again, she was in her career a deputy administrator for UNICEF. She was the Norwegian Minister of International Development during the period of time when these accords were fashioned. And then, as I mentioned, she was the special representative for the Secretary General of the United Nations in South Sudan for its first 3 years of independence. And so given that, a remarkable trajectory and set of accomplishments, please join me in welcoming her to Washington and to Brookings today.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Is this working? Yes, it is. I'll start with a quote. On 9 July 2011, Salva Kiir Mayardit, the president of South Sudan, said the following: "Our detractors have already written us off, even before the proclamation of our independence. They say we will slip into civil war as soon as our flag is hoisted. They justify that by arguing that we are incapable of resolving our problems through dialogue. They charge that we are quick to revert to violence. They claim that our concept of democracy and freedom is faulty. It is incumbent upon us to prove them all wrong." End quote. 2 years later, the detractors were proven right. Competition for political power had turned violent and would eventually shake the foundations of the new country. Before its third birthday, the dream of independence and freedom had turned into a nightmare. The liberators risked destroying the very country they had spent decades fighting for. How could this happen? In this book, which is called South Sudan, The Untold Story from Independence to Civil War, I'm trying to answer this question. How could this happen? As Minister of International Development of Norway, I was deeply involved in the CPA negotiations that completed the peace agreement by 2005. As I think most of you know, between the government of Sudan and the Sudan People's Liberation Movement and Army, the SPLMA. After almost five decades, Africa's longest civil war at the time ended, and the CPA did not grant the southerners independence, as many are thinking now, but self-determination. The parties were given unity a chance over an interim period of 6 years, after which southern Sudan would have the right to hold a referendum on its own future. So with the CPA then, southern Sudan had to go through at least three transitions, each extremely demanding. Firstly, transition from war to peace. For people who had known little but war, was a major shift. Secondly, transition from liberation struggle to government was another challenging one. Third was the complex transition to independence. And all three transitions were still underway after South Sudan voted overwhelmingly for independence in January 2011, and later on Independence Day, when I took the helm as SRSG and head of mission of UNMISS. I'll run through those three transitions quickly, and then at the end I'll talk about a few of the options. First, transition from war to peace. South Sudan was separated from Sudan in 2011 before all the terms of the divorce, quote-unquote, had been reached. Relations between the neighbors were expected to be difficult, but few of us foretold bombing raids hitting refugee camps, occupation of oil fields, and a complete shutdown of oil production in South Sudan. This, in turn, affected all efforts of state building and peace building. At the same time, South Sudan had major internal security problems. The country's largest state, Jonglei, was mired in a cycle of intercommunal violence in which thousands of civilians had been killed. Jonglei was also a microcosm testing the country's leadership and us in the United Nations. It was here we would face our greatest challenge prior to the December 2013 crisis and the civil war. But these problems were minor compared to what would come later. So the second transition, from liberation struggle to government, was predictably very difficult. The country was awash with weapons, mostly in civilian hands. Lack of commitment prevented necessary reform. This implied turning the liberation movement into a political party, for one, and the liberation force into a national army, too. Both processes stalled. The security sector was not reformed and contained tens of thousands of former militia, which were poorly integrated into the army. Command and control was poor, corruption rampant, and inflation in rank a major problem. The SPLA itself had 700 generals, the highest per capita in the world, I believe. Furthermore, the liberators failed to use the interim CPA period to strengthen the foundations on which the country could be built through stronger institutions. They also ignored numerous warnings against corruption and mismanagement. This liberation curse took hold where people felt entitled to power. It was their turn to eat. South Sudan was soon afflicted by the oil curse. So two curses, liberation curse and oil curse. Oil revenue became an irresistible temptation for cadres who had spent most of their lives in the bush. Resources lubricated patronage networks, while significant amounts were simply siphoned away to foreign bank accounts. And you will find a lot of detail on these corruption scandals in the book. And for the first time, by the way. Instead of cleaning up, at the very least at independence, the liberators continued to eat and institutions remained weak. I had many discussions with Princeton about this when we were in Juba. The third transition, the complex transition to independence, was therefore marked by continuity and very limited change. The people who expected to finally reap the fruits of peace and freedom saw their hopes dashed. They continued to wait for schools for their children, clinics for their sick, and roads to get to the markets. South Sudan ended up being, by far, the biggest spender of public funds in the region. Per capita, 3 times as much as Kenya and 4 times as much as Uganda. However, South Sudan spent 1/4 of their neighbors on education, 1/5 or 6 on health. It was more likely, and is still, that a teenage girl dies in childbirth than she will enter grade 8 at school. The money went elsewhere. It was ruled by the elite for the elite. Although attempts were made by the president to address the cancer of corruption in 2012, and we did try on our side to assist in that particular process, 5 steps against corruption, etc., they were not followed through. The liberation curse and the oil curse prevailed. This also implied that state institutions, including the army, were insufficiently developed to sustain the pressure of an escalating political crisis. So the institutions were weak. Then a few words about the crisis. The build-up to it started in the fall of 2012, and early attempts were made within the SPLM to engage the two leaders, Salva Kiir and Riek Machar, to avoid a leadership struggle. Did not succeed. Later, in early 2013, a committee was formed, chaired by Deng Alor, now the current foreign minister, and through a series of meetings amongst the cadres, they tried to resolve the leadership crisis internally. These efforts also came to a dead end. From July 2013 onwards, regional leaders flew in to help the Ethiopian foreign minister, the Kenyans, former President Thabo Mbeki and the AUHIP, South Africa's Cyril Ramaphosa and the ANC, they came in as well. Also other friends, discreetly unnamed, engaged. We all did. That violence could occur was clear to many of us, but high-risk behavior from a number of leaders made everything worse. This included 3 key actions. Firstly, the total exclusion of factions of the SPLM from the new cabinet, followed by political mobilization with public confrontation on both sides. Very dangerous. Secondly, actions and moves that could be interpreted as military preparation on both sides, including movement of additional security forces to the capital outside the SPLA's normal structures. Also, very risky. Thirdly, and not least, spinning of stories about arrests and disarmament in the last week before the important National Liberation Council. This was in December. In the end, Juba was like a powder keg. These series of actions contributed to what Barry Posen calls the security dilemma. Both sides took preemptive steps for their own protection, but ended up escalating the situation, and triggered by the acts of a few reckless individuals, it spun out of control. The South Sudanese leaders played with fire and allowed a power struggle to put everything they had fought for at risk. They all ignored the warnings, both from my side and other international and national stakeholders, that this would lead to ethnic violence. The last trigger was Salva Kiir's speech at the National Liberation Council. The speed, scale, and gravity of the December 2013 violence shocked everyone, including the South Sudanese leaders themselves. The massive killings and massacres of the Nuer on ethnic grounds in Juba triggered a response in kind. A shadowy group of people on the government side from the Dinka community of Baradazal had conducted the military operations, systematically killing along ethnic lines. The wholesale revenge came as a groundswell from below, making it possible for Riek Machar to mount sizable opposition forces in record time. With the SPLA splitting along ethnic lines, joined by the White Army, the opposition quickly reached numbers. These forces committed atrocities in equal measure. In other words, this was not a long-term plan. It was not a planned coup, and it was not a planned genocide. No one really planned for a civil war either. But the responsibility for the civil war, its escalation, and the current mess we're in, rests with the two leaders, Salva Kiir and Riek Machar. They had the opportunity to stop this senseless war a long time ago. They chose not to. and they chose not to. And then the obvious question comes, what about the UN? Could we have done more? I'm sure the international community, and myself included, could have done more. We all think about this when we reflect on what has happened. Still, as early as 18 months before the crisis, I tried to organize retreats within the leadership to address both critical reform issues in the country, among the leadership, and the tensions in the leadership. All five of the top leaders of the SPLMA agreed at least four times to meet, last in February 2013, in the middle of the crisis. In the end, it never happened. So, a leadership problem. Through numerous discussions with the chairman of the SPLM committee, Dengelor, I pushed for regional leaders to be brought in earlier to help resolve the crisis, already from March 2013 onwards. However, they still wanted to resolve the crisis by themselves, and he asked me to wait. When the regional leaders finally came in, it was probably too late. Now, could the UN have done more to stop the killings and massacres in Juba? Also an important question. During the last week of December, we had 150 soldiers that were not occupied protecting our two major bases. Our infantry battalions were elsewhere. In Jonglei, in particular, where civilians were seen to be most at risk, and we were expecting revenge attacks around this time, and the Security Council was expecting us to be present and protect. So our capacity to protect in Juba was very, very limited. So in the morning hours of 16 December, hundreds of civilians were gathering outside our gates, seeking protection from the violence that was firing off through many parts of the town. And then thousands came. They had been running for their lives. And at 7:30 a.m. in the morning of 16 December, I told our security to open the gates to our two bases in Juba to protect the civilians. And after this, as probably many of you know, thousands and thousands sought shelter within the UN base. I think during the first day it was 14,000 people at a scale never seen before in the UN's history. Anyone fleeing the violence, whether Nuer, Dinka or foreigners, all got refuge. And this repeated itself as the fighting continued throughout three of the states of the country. The number reached 140,000 during my time and has since reached 200,000. It was an absolute last resort and a decision fraught with problems. People are really suffering under very tough conditions. It's nothing that I would, you know, think that is an optimal solution for anyone. However, their lives were saved. The increased tensions between the government and the UN was then a fact. And this led to a lot of challenges. But it was much worse for the people. The outrageous atrocities committed on both sides in equal measure are an abomination. Mass killings on ethnic grounds, the systematic use of sexual violence as a weapon of war, women and girls being gang-raped and burnt alive in their dwellings, horrific crimes committed against children, not only child abduction, but castration, rape, murder. Acts of grave violence seem to be motivated as a generational attack on another ethnic group. This has never happened in South Sudan before. The atrocities committed were beyond comprehension, and the intransigence of the leaders appalling. It was as if people no longer mattered. After 18 months of negotiations by IGAD, the South Sudanese leaders finally signed a peace agreement in August 2015, with Riek Machar returning only in April 2016 to establish the transitional government. And the fundamental question we all have asked ourselves is this: can the same characters that caused the crisis now save South Sudan? We got a preliminary answer in July. South Sudan had just cancelled its independence celebrations, and I have to say, for good reason. After only 10 weeks of joint government, fighting erupted in Juba, and hundreds, if not a thousand or more, were killed. Targeted killings took place again, and Machar fled the capital. He was pursued by government security forces for weeks. South Sudan was once again plunged into the abyss. And now I'm getting to the way forward. The country was already imploding from within. the social fabric was tearing apart. Human suffering now reached unprecedented levels. Starvation and hunger, forced displacement and violence, conflicts all over the country, the blocking of humanitarian aid and protection forces, rule by the gun with predatory behavior against innocent civilians by almost all security forces. And the list is longer. All of this committed by South Sudanese against South Sudanese. Half the population of South Sudan, 6.1 million, are now in need of aid. 2.6 million have fled their homes. It's the worst humanitarian crisis after Syria. The betrayal committed by the liberators against themselves and their people is unprecedented in this history of the country. I think the freedom fighters and the martyrs would have turned in their graves. In another ironic twist, Taban Dengai, from a faction of the opposition, was then appointed first vice president, and the fate of the peace agreement was in question. At the same time, the security decided to send a regional protection force of 4,000 soldiers to the capital and called for the establishment of the hybrid court. South Sudan urgently needs not only to be saved from fighting, it needs to be saved from failing and from falling apart. This was my assessment when the book went to print in April 2016 and I wrote the epilogue. Now it is even more urgent. The country is in a downward spiral with increased ethnic violence and an unknown development. It is not long before developments in South Sudan will become irreversible. A rescue operation is urgently needed. How? The peace agreement is the only game in town. Or is it? It now has to be rescued and revitalized. It must be used as a basis for change. And to rescue it, three things are critical. Firstly, the actual and potential spoilers of peace must be stopped. This implies that all signatories of the peace agreement must be part of the solution. Exclusion of any of them creates more spoilers, worse spoilers, and increased fighting. Number two, the peace agreement will have to be adjusted. Both the security arrangements and power sharing arrangements would need to be reviewed. Number three, some kind of inclusive political process with a round table of all the political forces of South Sudan should be convened, paving the way for a caretaker government. This should probably be combined with external management of certain sectors that are in peril at the moment and that are key to save the country. This rescue operation will be needed for new leaders to take over. And as I say in the book, it is only the younger generation of South Sudanese leaders that can save South Sudan. They are ready, in fact, and they should be given the chance. The sooner, the better. And as Archbishop Desmond Tutu reminds us in the foreword of the book, and I quote, "In the midst of all the darkness, believing in this change is our hope," end quote. And thank you.
Hilda, fantastic presentation and amazing service on your part. I'm going to introduce Princeton and Brian in just a second, but I just wanted, and we'll explore after their remarks or during their remarks, and we'll explore your ideas at the end, certainly in more detail. But before we do that, recognizing that a lot of people in the room do know Sudan and South Sudan very well, I thought nonetheless maybe we could go over just a couple of basics for those who are sort of still catching up, and hopefully we'll read the book to catch up more. But could you just remind us, so we've gone over the independence trajectory in some detail. South Sudan is a relatively small country in terms of population, but relatively large in land area. Is that a fair way to say?
Yes.
10 or 12 million people? Or,
yeah.
And they're virtually all Christian? So this is not a confessional conflict. As you were saying, it's an ethnic conflict. To the extent that there is that kind of a dimension, and it's largely a Dinka Nuer. Those are the two major groups. Also correct?
Well, it's a political conflict that has turned ethnic. So it's very important that it basically is a power struggle. And it has just ethnic aspects to it, but it's basically a power struggle of taking control of the country and who holds control of the country. And then there are ethnic elements in that. And of course, ethnicity has been exploited in this power struggle.
Just two more background points, and then we'll go to Brian and Princeton for their reflections and comments. On the issue of the UN force that you alluded to, I believe it's a relatively large force by international standards, 12,000 or so, but it has fairly restrictive rules of engagement like most UN missions, right? In other words, this is not a peace enforcement force with a mandate to impose anything per se, but the regional protection force that has been proposed, would that have more robust rules of engagement if it were deployed, or would that just sort of be a reinforcement of the same kind of effort?
Well, you have a 12,000 force that is under the rules of engagement of the United Nations, which implies that it is a force with strong protection, Chapter 7 elements to it. But it does not have an intervention mandate or an enforcement mandate. To date, the only UN mission that has that is the Force Intervention Brigade of the Congo, in the northeast of Congo, the FIB. And I think there was discussions when the RPF, the Regional Protection Force, was raised as an important proposal from the region, there were discussions as to whether they would be given an interventionist or more robust mandate. If you read the Security Council resolution, that's less clear. And it has been not termed an intervention force, it's been termed a protection force. And it's going to have three roles, amongst them protecting strategic installations in the capital. You know, it's more of a stabilization type mandate in many ways than an intervention mandate. So, correct, it has a more robust mandate, but it does not go in the direction of an intervention force in the same way as the FIB has in Congo.
And I know we'll come back to this, and I know Brian and Princeton will want to comment on it as well, but just one last thing, just to get some of these basic facts and figures on the table. Let's just say a quick word about oil. Of course, oil was a big part of the issue in the separation of the two Sudans, and as your book makes clear, part of the deal for separation was that Sudan itself would receive a $26 a barrel transit fee, since it has the access to the sea that South Sudan lacks. When that was all negotiated, this was in the late 2000s when oil was $100 a barrel, $26 seemed like a modest fraction. Now it's the majority of the earnings. Could you just say another word about the oil economy and how that contributes?
Well, South Sudan, I didn't say that in my intervention, but South Sudan basically is bankrupt. I mean, it's hit rock bottom because you don't have any income anymore. At the time of when this book went to print, I calculated and we calculated that South Sudan was able to keep $4 a barrel, and that basically is close to nothing. At this point in time, they have a situation where they are in arrears to Sudan. For the fees and the deal that they got, as I'm saying in the book, they got a very lucrative deal, the Sudanese, on the transit fees. And of course, that it didn't have a clause of variation with the dollar fluctuations of the oil market is a big concern. That implies that Sudan is getting a huge amount. Actually, they are the ones benefiting from the production in the south, not South Sudan much. Now, the other aspect that one needs to know is that South Sudan is also being borrowing against future oil reserves, so and future oil production. So the country is heavily indebted. There's a discussion as to whether it's $4 or $7 billion, but it's really a huge debt, and it's basically been borrowing from the oil producers that are engaged in drilling in the country. They have borrowed or lent money to South Sudan against future oil reserves. So they are now in a situation where they've done two things. One is that, the other is domestic borrowing. So they've also exploited domestic borrowing significantly. Everyone knowing macroeconomic issues knows that that's a dead end. That's really not very wise. And it's a disastrous situation now for South Sudan. They're soon reaching... whether the economists will agree, I mean, they're soon reaching the level of hyperinflation. They have a certain technical kind of definition, but it's not far from it. So it's a complete crisis. So what also is happening is that, you know, what is already a humanitarian crisis of enormous proportions is now worsened by the fact that you have two things going on. One is the economic virtual collapse of the country, with also the inability to pay salaries for security forces. So one thing is normal people can't get, you know, purchase things on the market. One, they don't have cash. Two, the market, the prices are unbearable. But three, you know, you also have security forces that are without salaries, and the only way to survive is to attack civilians and grab from them. So you have a terrible situation for the civilians. And for the first time, in at least to my knowledge in South Sudan, you see numbers of beggars in the streets of Juba. This never, ever happens. For those who are South Sudanese, it's a total, you know, you do not beg. I mean, however bad the situation is, you never, ever beg. So it's different from culturally from many other countries. Absolutely a shame. And it's really against your full, you know, your integrity to do that. And now a lot of people in Juba are begging, and they just cannot survive. And so it's a disaster.
Thank you for that distressing but important picture to get on the table. So now I'd like to bring in Brian and Princeton in that order, and they're each going to speak for a few minutes, and then we'll have a broader discussion on where we go from here. But as I mentioned earlier, Brian Adeba is of South Sudanese origin, although I guess at that time, of course, it was the one Sudan, the southern part.
Yep.
Grew up in East Africa in general, ultimately made his way to our friends to the Great White North, and studied there in Waterloo, and I think worked on Canadian regulatory reform, if I'm not mistaken, and also was trained as a journalist en route to working on various aspects of East Africa's and specifically Sudan's various internal conflicts and governance challenges. And he's been doing this now with the Enough Project in Washington in the last recent times. Princeton Lyman, as I mentioned earlier, is undoubtedly one of America's great African experts and distinguished public servants. He was U.S. ambassador to both Nigeria and South Africa. He had a number of other postings in and about the region, also at the State Department on Assistant Secretary of State for International Organization issues and subjects dealing with Africa in many cases. And from 2011 to 13, therefore the first 2 years of South Sudan's independence, he was the United States Special Envoy to this troubled land. So he saw a lot of what Hilda was doing, and as she mentioned, they worked together on these issues during that period of time. So we'll look forward to hearing from both of you. Brian, over to you, please, for your perspectives. And as I mentioned, of course, you all know the Enough Project focuses on stopping genocide and mass killing, and that's certainly an ongoing concern in South Sudan, clearly.
Thank you. I'll make a few remarks about Hilda's book, and then I'll explore two themes in it that I think are critical. Hopefully we'll segue to Princeton. First of all, I want to say that this book is the most comprehensive book that has come out in recent years about happenings in South Sudan. In particular, the description of events leading up to 2013, that has been the most comprehensive description of what has happened, taking into consideration many viewpoints from different angles, and educating us, and basically for us, for some of us who keenly follow South Sudan issues, we were looking forward to reading that part on what exactly happened when the protagonist factions of the SPLM descended upon each other in December 2013. And I want to thank you for that. That being said, I want to look at one of the themes that I mentioned earlier, and this is the theme of the UN role in South Sudan. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the United Nations, the UNMISS mandate in South Sudan was broad. The challenges were great. It's just even amazing that someone would contemplate carrying out that mandate under those conditions. That being said, the UN did a lot of good work despite the challenges. However, one issue that will continue to dog it is the failure to protect civilians. As early as 2009, when I first visited South Sudan after many years, I visited a couple of towns, and I was basically trying to gauge opinion also about the role of the UN. And this was what I was told. These guys, they don't do nothing. When they hear shots, they just retreat to their barracks, hunker down and take defensive positions, and that's it. And this was 2009, and that label has stuck, and it has continued. And it is, in fact, an indelible label on the role of the UN. And even as the protection force, the so-called protection force, contemplates getting into South Sudan, that is an issue that will continue to dog it. While this may seem an indictment of Hilda's role as a special representative in South Sudan, I think the issue is also beyond her scope, for it originates actually at UN headquarters here in New York. It therefore opens up the conversation at a much broader level, and I think it behooves of us to ask the following questions of the international community. Why did the UN force, the UN mission in South Sudan, have the few resources that it had? Why were member countries not keen on contributing the troops that were needed to sufficiently ensure the protection of civilians? In Hilda's book, you find that there are mobility issues. They had, South Sudan has no infrastructure, and during the rain season, the rainy season, literally half of the country is submerged in water. And the only way to access regions or towns in order to for the UN to do its role was by air. And the UN's role in that respect was incapacitated by lack of helicopters, for instance. So why were these things happening at the UN, and why were they allowed to continue? But perhaps lack of resources also wasn't the only issue that dogged the UN mission in South Sudan. Perhaps lack of commitment by the UN troops also to fight. We've seen that incident in Melakal where basically the troops could have done more, but they did not. And it allowed militia to enter the protection of civilian site and kill people with impunity. So if that is the scenario, perhaps is it time that the Department of Peacekeeping in New York, is it time to hold member countries of UNMISS, those who are the countries that contribute troops to UNMISS, to hold them accountable, to hold those troops accountable for their failure to protect civilians? Is it time to explore punitive measures against countries that contribute troops and that allow their troops not to to engage in the role that they were supposed to, despite the robust mandate of the UNMISS mission in South Sudan? The second theme that I want to explore is the theme of corruption. We've just touched, she's touched about on it a few times in her presentation. I found an interesting description of corruption in her book. She does not downplay it. In fact, she actually says that it is one of the factors that probably contributed to the conflict, because there was a lack of oversight on the behavior of the political elite in South Sudan. Particularly, though, I was intrigued by her exploration of the theme of kleptocracy in South Sudan. And one sentence caught my attention where she says that blaming the conflict on kleptocracy is simplistic, and you know, we talk about, she delves into the postulations that have been made by people like Alex de Waal and the like. And she says that, in fact, President Kiir took decisive measures to combat corruption and launched some ambitious steps to thwart that vice. In other words, she was suggesting, actually, that there was a genuine effort or desire to combat corruption. But when you look at what has happened, the truth of the matter was that despite the public pronouncements by the president to combat corruption, there wasn't actually any desire to do that. And that was because the institutions of governance that were supposed to provide oversight on the actions of the political elite in South Sudan had actually been hijacked you know, and incapacitated through various means. I'll just touch on a few steps on how that has happened.
Maybe if I could just suggest.